This is an ABC podcast.
Today on Conversations, two stories of almost lost trades from country Australia. The first from Warwick in the southern downs of southeast Queensland. That's where Judith Anderson grew up, in a house right beside the Brown Family Bakery, run by her father and her Swedish-American grandfather. Hi, Judith.
Hello, Sarah.
Now, this isn't your first time before a microphone, is it? Tell me what happened in Warwick when you were a kid.
Oh, Warwick was a fantastic community to grow up in. It's the old story, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. So there were so many wonderful opportunities, and amongst them, the local radio station invited the children from Warwick East State School to come in and read something of their choice. So I went in, I'm assuming it was weekly, I really don't recall clearly, and I would read a chapter from a book.
What book did you choose?
Well, I'm sorry to say it was The Famous Five.
No apologies needed. I would have loved to have sat next to the radio hearing you read a chapter from The Famous Five. How delightful. Did you get fan mail?
No.
It's not too late.
But it did give me a moment of lasting shame, because I had never said the word colonel before. I pronounced it colonel. And it wasn't until many years later that I felt redeemed when I discovered that's how you pronounce it in French.
You were bringing a bit of French pronunciation onto the Warwick airwaves. I will also now refer to it as colonel in sympathy, Judith. So as I say, you grew up right next to your family bakery. How good did that smell in the morning?
It was amazing, because if you're a baker, or in those days and to a lesser extent today, you get up late at night, you make the doughs, and then there's a series of doughs made through the night and baked. So, you know, your work hours are from late at night until early in the morning. And the first thing in the morning was that Dad or my grandfather would arrive in the kitchen with a freshly baked loaf of bread. And that, it has always been, you know, the best smell. It takes me straight back.
What would you have on it, Judith? What was your favourite topping on that fresh bread?
Well, the best thing was actually, if it was a half loaf, what they called a married loaf could be broken in half, and you had that lovely soft crumb inside. And as a child, you always think you're never going to be detected if you take out that soft crumb and just eat it. But of course, somebody always did. So it was just the soft crumb on its own.
Were you allowed to wander in and out of the bakery as you wanted as a kid?
I was, and I realised that today's workplace health and safety regulations would certainly not allow that. You know, for instance, in one end of the bakery, and I can still see it in my mind's eye, my dad had cut an old 44-gallon drum in two. And two of the essential ingredients in making bread and buns, that sort of thing, is salt. So one of these half drums was filled with salt. The other one was full of sultanas. And I used to sit on the salt and dip into the sultanas. I still love sultanas. But just watching the process going on and being surrounded by that warmth, and just knowing the way that that whole process worked. And being allowed to, when I was a little bit older, I remember I had a friend who came to stay, and it was Mother's Day, and we decided we would make a Mother's Day cake. And we went over into the bakery and made a disastrous Mother's Day cake, because we knew nothing about bakery ovens.
But you had the freedom to experiment.
Exactly.
What about the workshop where your dad and granddad spent time too? What was that like for you as a kid?
That was fantastic. It was an essential part of our life, you know, because they were both of them extremely good with their hands. My grandfather was a self-taught do-everything man. In the course of living in Warwick, he built three caravans. He also built boats. When he was in New Zealand, he built a canoe, and with a man who was one of his mates, went down one of the previously unnavigated rivers in New Zealand. I mean, he could do stuff. So building boats and caravans and carts and all the rest of it was just an essential part of our life. And so was the workshop. And again, I was allowed free rein in that workshop, you know. I've still got the tack hammer that I learnt to hammer nails in with.
What sort of figure was your granddad to you as a little girl? What did he look like through your eyes?
He must have been larger than life. He certainly had a huge influence on the way I view the world. He was a very calm man. I never saw him lose his temper. In fact, I never heard angry words in our home as a child, which is, I realise now, an absolute blessing. And that sense of the life that he had lived was, he didn't ever sit me down and tell me the stories, but I knew about them just through little things that were mentioned, you know. So I knew that he had come from a Swedish family, 11 boys, 7 of whom migrated to the US. And his mum had been one of a family of 7 boys and girls, of whom 6 had migrated to the US. So there was this really strong Swedish thing. And he gave me books of Swedish fairy stories. It was just that general introduction to the fact that I had Swedish origins.
How did your own father want to honour that Swedish ancestry when your brother was born?
Oh, that was a delightful moment in our family, because he decided that Ragnar would be the best name for my baby brother. I'd been an only child for 13 years, and then this boy arrives. Yes, he's going to carry the Swedish name. And my mum, bless her, said, I don't think that's going to work in the schoolyard in Warwick for a little boy. So he, Ragnar, sadly, faded into history. And that's only today in television programs like The Vikings that we hear Ragnar as a name.
What was he named? What was he christened instead?
The compromise was Calvin. Well, that's, Calvin.
That's still fairly strong, Calvin, as a first name.
It is. And one of the problems with our family name, Brown, is that there's not a lot.
You've got to differentiate it at the front.
Distinguish it, yes. So,
and I think inside every Calvin there's a little Ragnar waiting to just burst out.
I must tell him that.
So you say that your dad, working at the bakery, would start work at about midnight.
Yes.
And work all through the
That's
night.
Right.
When did he sleep, Judith?
Oh, this was another thing about growing up, is that I always had to be very quiet during the afternoons, because that's when Dad was asleep. And fortunately, there weren't noisy children in the family at that time. And I think that helped me in a way to be a very self-contained, self-sufficient, self-reliant person, is that I didn't have tribes of other children around playing. I was, Dad was asleep, I had to be quiet, so I became a great reader, and I wrote a newspaper when I was about 10. I made little movies, and I made a little movie screen in the workshop to make these movies. Those sorts of things, what I occupied my time with.
Was he always tired? Do you have that memory of him?
He had huge energy and strength as a man, which was wonderful, especially when I look at him as a younger man. Some of the things that he did when they migrated from New Zealand, they brought with them as deck cargo on the ship a 1925 Harley Davidson motorbike that had been their transport in New Zealand. And this motorbike then, when my dad grew up, became his bike. And my favourite story about the bike is that when he and Mum were married in Warwick in April of 1943, my dad, his best man and his groomsman all travelled up from Amberley to Warwick across Cunningham's Gap on the bike. one of them on the pillion, the other one on the petrol tank. How they made it, I don't know, but they got there in time for the wedding.
And that strength that he had, that was actually important in being a baker too back then. I mean, tell me about the flour bags. If we go through the process of making bread, we start with the flour. How big were those bags?
And those, the bags then were 150 pounds. That's a lot of flour.
So that's something you've got to hoist up on your back,
you
really, isn't it?
Yes, yes. You have a bag hook that helps you to hoist it onto your back, and then it's taken over and dropped into the mixing bowl.
And then would they mix by hand, or how did that start?
No, I was a child, they did have mechanical mixers. But in the earlier times, of course, no, they would have been mixed by hand.
And, of course, that crucial element in the magic of bread is yeast. Were they making their own yeast in the 40s and 50s?
When I was a child, they weren't. It was manufactured as bricks of compressed yeast. But every baker, even when I was a child, still had their own recipe for making their own yeast. And it was based on potatoes. And you had to have that because there was no yeast manufactured in Queensland until the 1950s. It's so recent, and you don't realise that until you start digging, that all their yeast supplies had to come from Sydney.
Oh, and so people would make their own.
And so people would make their own yeast. And it also led to a wonderful sense of all of the bakeries in town, and there were six of them, that they were in competition, but it was collaborative because you never knew when you were going to run out of yeast or when a dough would fail for whatever reason. So you needed to be able to rely on your competitors to help you in that time. And, of course, that doesn't exist anymore.
How would a baker know when the dough was ready for baking after they've mixed it in that industrial mixer and added the yeast and the salt and the water? When's it ready?
It's one of those, I use the word alchemy because it really is. These people get to know the feel of the dough, and there are these testing methods of pushing your fingers into the dough, and you know by how far the fingers go into the dough, whether it's ripe or overripe or underripe. And I've had wonderful conversations with a man who, it turns out, lived in the house over the road from me when I was a child, but I didn't know him then. He was a few years younger than I was. But he has been marvellous in sharing information about these processes that, I mean, as a child, as an observer, I knew that the bread was being made, but those actual processes I wasn't aware of. And my favourite is how they used to decide whether the oven was hot enough. And they would just take a handful of flour and cast it into the hot oven. If it flared into flames, they knew it was ready. And that really is alchemy, isn't it?
Once the dough had passed the finger test or whatever mysterious method was being used, what happened to it next?
Well, then there was the process of putting it into the tins. And that's something I really do remember so clearly, because there was just a set of old balance scales and there'd be the pile of dough. And using just a simple blade, the bakers would slice off a chunk of the dough, throw it into the tray of the scale. And they were so accurate, and they could do it at such speed. And then, of course, it was put into the tins and allowed to rise again. I've always loved watching tradesmen at work, you know, that skill that's
and the
involved.
Grace and the expertise and speed.
It is. There's a fluidity and beauty to it.
And then what kind of oven was there in your family bakery?
All of the ovens then, at the time when I was growing up, were what they call a Scotch oven. And no one quite knows why they're called Scotch ovens. I was digging quite deeply into that. There were a lot of Scots bakers, but they're brick and sand, fundamentally. So you have a brick base with a curved roof, a domed roof, and it's all surrounded by sand. on the exterior of the walls, you need really strong reinforcement. And on our own bakery, they had, you know, they were the size of railway sleepers that were attached to the side of, to the external walls, to retain that enormous weight of sand that was inside.
And that's how the heat was transmitted through the sand.
Of course, yes. And so it took hours, you know, a day to heat it from cold. But, of course, once it was fully heated, then you had to manage the heat. And so bread was baked first when the oven was at its hottest, then the buns and those sorts of things, and last of all, the cakes, because I didn't know in that day when I was baking the Mother's Day cake.
So were the ovens kept on all the time then if they took so long to heat up?
Well, it was a 7 day a week or 6 day a week trade. So the ovens would be refired every day using wood. And I remember the wood yard. We had a yard full of wood. And Dad used to go down to the local sawmill and load up the truck with the wood. When it came back to the bakery, it had to be unloaded. Again, that's another aspect of that, the physical work involved.
I guess each baker must have got to know the intricacies or uniqueness of their own Scotch oven very well.
Yes,
I mean, this is,
yes,
again, an inexact kind of science.
It is. And there are some gorgeous stories that talk about, you know, the oven weeps as the water comes from the bricks. And it just those, that relationship between the baker and his oven, and it was always his oven in those days, was a very intimate thing.
This is Queensland, though. I mean, I can imagine that lovely, warm bakery would have been a beautiful place to be in winter, in June,
Warwick,
July.
In the winter it was.
What about in summer?
Yes. So those aspects of the job were really, really tough. And in my dad's case, of course, he not only had to bake the bread, but then deliver it as well.
So did people come and buy bread from the bakery, or was it always being delivered?
Some of them did. And another of the wonderful memories I have, there was a Syrian family that lived just down the road. And Mr. Maroon used to come up to the bakehouse every morning, and my dad would bake, especially for him, three huge flat breads, just putting them on the floor of the oven. And he would come up with those, and I can still see him with those three discs of bread tucked under his arm, walking down the lane to go home. But most of the bread was delivered until the 1950s, when my dad decided to open a shop in the main street.
So who did the delivering? Was it your dad or your granddad?
Both of them, actually. My grandfather was very inventive. He invented several advanced model bakery carts with all sorts of features. But my poor dad, they had come to Australia from New Zealand. He wasn't quite 14. It was just before his 14th birthday. No choice other than to work for his father. And there was a lovely newspaper report that I found when it said that Ralph Brown, aged 15, had been the driver of a delivery cart which had ended up in the Condamine River because the horse had bolted. And this is July, you know.
And did the horse drown? What happened?
Oh, I love newspaper reports because there was no mention of the fate of the horse. There was only passing mention of my father, but it did say that only 30 loaves of bread were lost.
the important element
the important
in that
yes.
story. What about trucks? When did your family move from horse and carts to delivery vans and trucks?
Yes, that was one of the first things that my grandfather built was a spectacular six-wheeled vehicle. I think he had rejigged a motor vehicle from the 1930s, and he had attached this cart to the back, which had four wheels on it, and he used that. But then my dad, when he came out of the Air Force, purchased five Blitz trucks, these big army trucks. And because of the skills that he had, he did them up, refurbished them, painted them, and sold them. But he kept the best one for himself. And that truck then became everything that we used. It was used to deliver bread. It was used to go on picnics. And then, of course, the next thing that happened was we upgraded to a real car when we got our first Holden utility.
How did that Holden utility that your family purchased in 1952, how did it come back into your life?
It's just the most extraordinary story. I had a phone call almost a year ago, last April, from a man who said, I think I have your dad's 1952 FX Holden. And first of all, of course, I was a little wary. I thought, what is this? He had tracked me down relentlessly. He'd found my birth notice, for example, in the Warwick Daily News back in 1945. He'd gone onto Ancestry.com and had found a connection there. Undeterred, he then found a cousin in the US who was able to tell me that, you know, this person was seeking to find me, to make contact. And it's just been a wonderful exploration of the history of this ute, because I realised, although I knew from my child perspective that we had a ute, and yes, we used to go down to Byron Bay for holidays with it, and it was used to deliver the bread, I had no idea what had happened to that ute at the end of its life. It has been just an amazing...
I am intrigued by this fellow who was so desperate to seek the ancestry of his ute. Do you know what was motivating him?
He wanted to know the provenance of this vehicle, because he is restoring it in such detail. And so that's why he was absolutely thrilled when I could provide him with photographs of the vehicle, because he could see that it had the Venetian blind on the back window, that it had a visor over the windscreen.
Do you remember where you'd sit in that car? What was your spot? In
the middle, because, you know, no seat belts, but, you know, Dad would drive, Mum would sit in the passenger seat, I'd sit in the middle with the dog, and, you know, we would drive down through Wallangarra and then go down to Byron Bay that way, and we'd camp on the beach in Palm Valley. I mean, it was idyllic. You know, I'd walk down onto the beach and the fishermen would be pulling in nets of fish, and I'd take fish back up to the tent very proudly.
How had your mum and dad met and started courting? What's the story there, Judith?
Oh, it's a really romantic story, because, as I said, Dad was a baker. He was working 6 days a week, but his Saturday nights he had off. He had met my mum. They were at the Warwick show, and they were both looking at the art exhibition. I don't know what it was, but something was sparked there. She was an incredibly vivacious woman. She would have just charmed the socks off him, because he was a very shy, diffident man. So they started to court one another.
And she worked in the movie cinema time. And how would they spend time together there?
She worked in King's Theatre, and on a Saturday night, his one night off, she used to let him in to sit in the back of the theatre, because she was elevated to the level of the dress circle usherette. He was able to be seated in the back of the dress circle, and when she had a break, she would go and just sit beside him. And he said, yeah, I sat through some dreadful movies just to be with her. It's just so sweet. And afterwards, she would change out of her uniform, and they would go around to the local cafe, the Bellevue Cafe, which is still there in Warwick today, and have tea and toast, and then he would walk her home. And it's very romantic.
Your granddad was born in the US to a Swedish family. How did he end up in New Zealand?
So he and a mate had gone down to San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake, to just have a look at the damage. And San Francisco at the time was a wild town, and they were robbed. All they had was a single silver dollar, which he had hidden in his shoe. And that silver dollar I still have. It's just one of those wonderful icons of the family that has been passed down. They toss the coin, and the bizarre decision was, okay, we'll go to Alaska and pan for gold, or we'll go to New Zealand.
So New Zealand won the toss. In New Zealand, your granddad married and had a family, and then he moved them all over to Australia and onto this baking glory in Warwick, where you, of course, came along, Judith. What expectations were there of you growing up?
I will be forever grateful to my dad that he did not want me to suffer what he had. I mean, he was taken out of school just before his 14th birthday in New Zealand, brought to Australia, no choice other than to work for his father in the bakery. But the value of education, he was just so insistent that I should have an education. So I'll be forever grateful to him for that, because my mum died at the beginning of my senior year. I had just turned 17, and I thought, well, that's it. There are the two little brothers. I will have to stay home and look after them. But no, he insisted that I should go to university. Life went on from there.
And so you did. You moved away from the bakery, moved away to go to university.
Yes.
What was it like to wake up without that freshly cooked loaf of bread waiting for you on the kitchen table?
It still takes me back. Whenever I smell it, it takes me straight back.
Judith, it's beautiful to hear your memories of growing up in Warwick. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Entirely my pleasure.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski.
Judith Anderson's book is Earning a Crust. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.